So it's May 20th, 2013 at Bhaktivedanta Manor, London, England, and we were asked to give a two-part seminar on the Bhagavatam. So what we're going to do is today is part one, tomorrow is part two. Today we're going to look at the value of the Bhagavatam. And so today we're going to look at the what. And tomorrow we're going to look at the how. So today is the value, and then tomorrow is how do you get that value. Okay. Today, what is the treasure? Tomorrow, how do you find it? Is that all right? Is that okay? Yes? Okay. So the verse that we're going to, that kind of invocation verse we're going to use, is this glorification of the Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 3, Text 43. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. This Bhagavata Purana is as brilliant as the sun, and it has arisen just after the departure of Lord Krishna to his own abode, accompanied by religion, knowledge, etc. Persons who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of ignorance in the age of Kali shall get light from this Purana. So, what do we find in the Bhagavatam? Well, you could say the first thing, the most obvious answer, is that we find philosophy. We find answers to the real questions of life. And those answers cannot be found, as far as I know, this thoroughly anyplace else. If you read the other scriptures of the world, you will not get the kind of detailed answers as you will find in the Bhagavatam. So other scriptures may tell you God is great, God is the creator, gives you a list of rules of how to live in the world. Don't wear this kind of clothes, don't eat this kind of food, don't do this, and don't do this. But what philosophy does the Bhagavatam give us? The philosophy gives us, the Bhagavatam goes from past the Bhagavad Gita, the nature of the soul, the movements of the living entity, how we're moving from one body to another, how we get our different karma, how we get entangled in this world, the forest of material enjoyment, how the whole world is moving. Movements of time according to the atom, how all the planets are moving, how everything was created in detail. Again, other scriptures may just say, God said, let there be light, and then there was water, and then there was sky, and then there was earth. And in about four or five verses, they're finished with the creation. Whereas we have chapter after chapter going into detail how the Lord expands in the different Purushas and breathes out the universes, how the different elements combine together. If you were to have the misfortune, as I did, of having to take a graduate level course on the philosophy of research, and you find out how people try to guess at what is the process by which the living entity perceives things. How do we see? How do we hear? Is anything real, or does it exist only as perceptions in the mind? What's the relationship between the self, the mind, the senses, and the sense objects? And they can't figure it out at all. They have this speculation, and that, when I took that course, I said, oh, that's mental speculation. That's what Prabhupada means by mental speculation. So I just sat in the back and read songs. But anyway, so they're trying to guess these things, and this is all in the second and third canto of the Bhagavatam. What is the relationship between the soul, the mind, the senses, the sense objects? How do we interact with the world? And of course, then the philosophy of the ultimate reality. Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavaniti, Sabjite. The different manifestations of the absolute. Most religions and philosophy only know Brahman, or maybe Brahman and Paramatma. The all-pervading, or God as the creator, God as the father, the maintainer, he who gives out the material energy, the witness, the friend, the abode, like that. And they don't go beyond that. very unusual to get information of Bhagavan. And if you go to other Vedic scriptures, which does give this information, then those other scriptures are also full of karma and gyan and dhyan. They're mixed. They're saying, yes, okay, there's Bhagavan, but worship him to go to Swarga. Or the ultimate goal, yes, there's Bhagavan, but the ultimate goal is merging with the Brahman, or the ultimate goal is mystic cities, or something like that. So, Kaitava Dharma, this cheating religion, is thrown out of the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam tells us about it. The Bhagavatam gives us instances of persons who wanted to go to heaven, or persons who wanted to merge with the Brahman, and shows us how all of this is cheating religion, and only prema is the highest truth. So if one wants to understand, if one wants knowledge, if one wants to understand the truth, that should be the most basic criteria to be a religion. You know, nowadays, religion is defined as anything which answers ultimate questions of life and has symbols and a process for trying to achieve it. That's kind of like saying food is anything you put in your mouth. You can put all kinds of things in your mouth that aren't food. The definition of food should be that which nourishes you. Yeah, right. So the real definition of religion should be that which satisfies you. Savaipum sampro dharma yato bhaktir and hoiktache ahoituki apritiyata yad yatma supersediti. The dharma that gives you satisfaction. Pratyakshavagamam dharmam susukam kartamaviyam. That when you experience it, it brings you happiness. So the Bhagavatam also is not just philosophy. If you could imagine 12 cantos of philosophy, who would read it? Few people. The Bhagavatam is not just philosophy. All the philosophy is in the context of... What's the philosophy packaged in? Stories. The whole Bhagavatam is a big story. There's all the sages at Namasharanya getting blackened by the smoke and not getting anywhere. And they go to Suta Goswami, and there's Romaharshan Suta who gets killed with the kusha straw. And then, what stories? And then inside that story, there's Maharaj Parikit, who somehow gets angry when he gets thirsty and puts the dead snake around the sage's neck and then gets cursed to die by a snake bird. Sounds like a dragon. In 7 days, he goes to the Ganga, and then inside that story, there's so many other stories. Kardava Muni and Devahuti, who have a flying city. The demons and the demigods who fight on red-faced monkeys and black-faced monkeys and deformed human beings and vultures and fish. There's so many amazing stories. It's not just philosophy. It's not just, okay, this happened, this is this. It's not like that. Every single verse of the Bhagavatam is inside of a story. And it's in, most of them are inside of a story that's inside of a story that's inside of a story that's inside of a story, which psychologists say is the kind of stories that human beings like the most. Stories within stories. And we're wired to like stories because Krishna likes stories, because that's what he does. Stories, all the time. By Leela, he's doing stories. Stories means, if you can remember way back when you were in school, there's an introduction, a rising action, a crisis, a falling action, and a conclusion. You all remember that? Or did you just write that on the exam and then forget about it? So to be a story, there has to be some suspense. You meet the characters, then there's some problem and there's suspense and you don't know what's going to happen. And is this going to happen or is that going to happen? And there's some kind of crisis or some kind of climax or some kind of problem. How are we going to solve the problem? And then there's a decision made. And then there's the results of that decision. And then there's everything tied up at the end in a nice little conclusion. Right? So that first you meet Ambarish, the great king, Savaimana Krishna Padara Vindayo, and he's following a codicy, and you set the stage, and then you have this Durvasa comes, and he goes, and you have this rising action, and then there's this crisis, where he creates this demon to kill Ambarish. And then what's going to happen? And then he's chased all over the universe by the Sudarshan Chakra. And finally he comes and apologizes. And then at the conclusion, Ambarish and Durvasa become friends. So there's story after story like that. And we are designed as souls to relish such stories. Krishna has such stories himself in Goloka Vrindavan over and over and over again. He's in the stories and he likes hearing about the stories. You know, every night there's dramas of stories in Goloka Vrindavan. You know that, right? There's entertainment in Goloka Vrindavan. And then before Krishna goes to bed, Mother Yasoda tells him a story. And she says, one time, Krishna, there was this little boy named Prahlad. And she tells him a story. So we also like stories. And stories are the most powerful means for changing one's values. And there's a whole science behind that, which I don't have time to tell right now. But people's values, their character, culture, are formed more through stories than practically any other way. Therefore, every society has transmitted its culture and its values through stories. If you think about how has the modern secular, you know what secular means? Modern secular culture. So secular means no God. That you do not, it's the opposite of chakra. Shastra chakshus, thank you. It's the opposite of shastra chakshus, just like in this verse we have nastajisham. They don't have any vision. So secular is nastajisham. Instead of shastra chakshus, instead of having the vision of seeing things through the philosophy of theology, you see everything materially. That's what secular means. All the explanations for everything is absent theology. Does that make sense? If you read a newspaper or a magazine or watch the news on television or like that, will they explain the day's events through religion and philosophy? No, they'll explain. Or you go to school, they'll explain it all through materialism. And life is just materialistic. That's secular. When we were producing our children's books, we looked at dozens and dozens of different reading schemes. And the thing that jumps out at you the most is that there was no God. There was no religion. Even if they wanted to be very multicultural and show people having different festivals, God was absent from the festivals. So here's an Indian family celebrating Diwali. But there's no Ram. There's just lights. So this is secular. Secular also means individuals will interpret their life sans religion. When people understand, why did I get sick? Why is this happening? What's my purpose in life? They don't use shastra chakshus. They don't use a lens of religion. That's what secular means. And secularism has two branches, one called positivism, one called post-positivism, or modernism and post-modernism, which have nothing to do with time, by the way. And positivism means there is an objective truth that you can understand through your senses and logic. That's what we call scientific method. And post-positivism is there's absolutely no absolute truth, which you can think about that for a little bit. There's absolutely no absolute truth. Whatever anybody decides is truth for them is truth for them. So these are the two brands of secularism that are circling the globe. You've run into these, I assume, yes? One of them is there's an objective absolute truth that's material and you can only understand it through material means. That's what we call the hard sciences. And the other is there's absolutely no absolute objective truth, which is, of course, an absolute statement of objective truth. And everybody just finds their own truth. Everybody can find their own meaning, and everyone's truth and everyone's meaning is equally true or equally untrue, I suppose. So how have these ideas spread all over the world? Through somebody arguing them logically through philosophy? No, through stories. And how were the stories transmitted? You all know the answer to this. Through the media, yes? Yes? How is it that even in very religious societies, most people have now become secular? Because they watch television and movies. What are they watching? Philosophy? Are they watching philosophy? When they turn on the television, there's some deep philosophical discussion of whether the absolute truth is material or spiritual. No, they're just watching stories. And these stories change people's values. Again, that would be at least 20 minutes to describe why and how stories have that effect. So the Bhagavad Gita is full of stories. It's stories and stories and stories and stories within stories. Therefore, it's very captivating. And of course, there's personalities in those stories. And when one reads the Bhagavad Gita, because the Bhagavad Gita is not an ordinary book, one's actually associating with those personalities. Frankly, even in ordinary stories, even ordinary stories about fictional characters, one is associating with those personalities. Oh, maybe I should tell it. I'll try to tell it very briefly. I just can't resist. I'm sorry. So I'm sure you're aware that athletes sometimes before they perform, when they're practicing, they sometimes practice their sport mentally. Are you aware of that? So they may just sit down and they're not moving, and they're just mentally hitting the ball. You're aware of this? This is one way that athletes practice. And research has shown that when you mentally go through an action, that your brain and your muscles are activated 2/3 of the extent as when you're doing it physically. I mean, you can try this yourself if you're learning a new skill. If you practice it mentally, when you go to do it physically, it'll be easier. It'll be as if you also practiced it physically. So a similar thing happens with stories. When we hear, read, or see stories, what happens is we almost become the characters in the story, and we live through those characters and experience what they're experiencing, almost the same as if we were literally experiencing it. I'm sure if you've read a book or watched a film, you've noticed that you get emotions of the characters. You get even a physiological reaction. If somebody's watching a scary movie, they'll perspire and so forth. Yes? Why? Because what's happening, and they can do this with brain scans. If the character in the story picks up a piece of cloth, in your brain, you're picking up a piece of cloth. So whatever stories we hear, we're practicing that behavior. This is one of the reasons, not the only reason, but it's one reason why stories are very powerful at changing people's behavior and changing people's values, and why we're enjoined not to meditate on stories of materialistic persons. So this is true even on a material level. But Bhagavatam is also acting on a spiritual level. So even on a material level, when we're reading the stories of these personalities, we're reading about Ambarish, and we're reading about Kardama, and we're reading about Vidura, we're practicing following in the footsteps of those people on a subtle level. And because the Bhagavatam is spiritual, those personalities are actually present in the stories. So we are getting their association on every level. And we all know that we tend to become like our association. I was speaking a while ago to one devotee who's lapsed in her practices. And we were talking about how she could try to do things that were more spiritual. And I asked her, what do you like in Krishna consciousness? So she was telling me. And then she said, but maybe I should also tell you what I like that's not Krishna conscious. I said, okay. So she was telling me that. And then she said, now this isn't exactly something that I like, but I want to be normal. I said, well, what do you mean exactly? She said, well, when I'm with people at my work, I don't want them to think that I'm strange. So this is, again, our natural tendency, that we want to be like the people with whom we associate. We're social beings. And when we're reading the stories of the Bhagavatam, we are literally associating with those personalities. And therefore, our natural inclination, it's a spiritual inclination because the spiritual world is full of living entities, our natural spiritual inclination to be part of a group and be accepted by that group will then operate. And we'll think, well, I'd like to be accepted by Devahuti. I'd like to be accepted by Vidura. I'd like to act in such a way that they look at me and say, you're normal. I want to be normal to them. Well, now, we not only have the Bhagavatam itself, the philosophy in the Bhagavatam, the stories of the Bhagavatam, the personalities of the Bhagavatam, but what else do we have? We don't just have the verses. We also have the purports. And Prabhupada said these purports are his ecstasies. So, you know, Rupa Goswami says that even a materialistic person in association with a great devotee can experience shadow or reflective ecstasy. That means just by reading the purports, we can get a shadow or a reflection of Srila Prabhupada's ecstasies. And Srila Prabhupada says in the Nectar Devotion that one can go from that shadow or reflective ecstasy immediately to real ecstasy. So we're in touch not only with Srila Prabhupada's vision and Prabhupada's preaching, but Prabhupada's mood. And of course, in the purports, we're getting Srila Prabhupada's vision of how to understand and apply the verses of the Bhagavatam to our present time. Prabhupada says it's required not only to keep the principles, but to apply them to time, place, and circumstance. And Prabhupada's doing that for us in the purports. So we can pick up on Srila Prabhupada's mood, Srila Prabhupada's ecstasy, and then we can also learn practically, okay, what do I do with this verse? What do I do with what the Bhagavatam's saying here? You know, here's Kardama building a flying city. I can't do that. Anybody here can build flying cities? You're just not revealing your mystic power yet to anybody. So, you know, what do I do with that? And I've never seen wars where people are riding on red-faced monkeys and Timangila fish and... Right? Or Kasyapa's wives who give birth to snakes and birds and lions. And so I've helped deliver a lot of babies, but none of them were lions. I never was with a devotee lady and whoop, what's that? So how do you apply this to our life? What do you do with it? And Srila Prabhupada's taking in the purport from these stories and these personalities to right now. To Kali Yuga, to right now, even to the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And of course, Srila Prabhupada's purports, what do they have within them? They have the commentaries of the previous acharyas. So when we're reading Srila Prabhupada's purports, we're not only associating with Srila Prabhupada, we're associating with Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati and Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Jiva Goswami and Sridhar Swami. And Sanatana Goswami, and their moods, and their ecstasies, and their revelations about how to apply the philosophy in one's own life. So it's not just some philosophy up there. Oh, what a nice philosophy. But it comes right to our lives. So I'm sure there's a lot more in the Bhagavatam, but those were the main things that came to mind. Philosophy stories, personalities, Prabhupada's ecstasies, realization, application in the purports, and the previous acharyas' ecstasies, revelations, and applications in the purports. All right. Sounds like a nice party to go to, huh? So you get there. There you are in the Bhagavatam. What's going to happen to you? Might be a good thing to know, huh? What's going to happen? I don't know if we should reveal this, though, because everybody might run away. Sometimes I'm a little hesitant, especially when I'm giving a class to people very new to Krishna consciousness, to tell them what's actually going to happen when they take up Krishna consciousness. Nobody told me what was really going to happen. So should I tell you? Yes. I just discovered, I mean, just, because I prepared this a while ago, but just when I sat down here, I discovered something in my notes that I went, oh my God. Somehow or other, I had put the power of the Bhagavatam, I'd gotten four things, and I'd put them in an order that ends up being the order of the progression of bhakti. And I didn't intend to do that. I didn't even know I did that. So we'll just go with it. I love it when things like that happen. So the first thing that we're going to look at is that Bhagavatam cleanses the heart. Shinvitan swakata krishna punya shravanam kirtana ridyantasta abhadrani vidyunoti suritsida. So if we look at the word for word, Shrinvitam. And Prabhupada translates this as those who have developed the urge to hear the message of, the desire, not just your hearing. Recently I was in a temple, and in my first seminar, I asked people, so why have you come? What do you hope to get out of this seminar? And one of the members of the audience says, I'm here because they tell me I have to go if I want to get fed. Well, at least you're honest. You know, so one should have some urge to hear the Bhagavatam. One should have some excitement and not just this is something I got to do every day. And then ridyantasta. Rid means the heart. Anta within, sta, the place within the heart. And then abhadrani, bhadra means auspicious. Abhadrani, which is not auspicious. Prabhupada says the desire to enjoy matter. Then surit. Surit, rid means heart, su means very dear, very auspicious, very good, very beautiful. So one who's very dear to the heart. I mean, we're lucky if we have a few friends like that in this world. I mean, we all have friends, people we say Haribo to and think, what was their name? And other people that we see sometimes and work with. But we have a few surits, right? Maybe you have only one, maybe you have two or three. People who really are dear to your heart. They really care. You know, when you leave your body, they won't just think, oh, great, feast. You know, they're concerned about what you do. If you tell them what you did today, they want to listen at least for 5 or 10 minutes, you know. And they see your bad qualities and they don't think you're a demon, and they see your good qualities and they don't think you're a saint. They just see you for who you are, and they deal with you as who you are, and they like you for who you are. So that's surit. And then take that person, if you can think about that person in your life, I'm sure hopefully all of you have at least one, I hope, and multiply that by a few billion times. So that's Krishna, who thoroughly knows us. None of our surits in this life thoroughly know us, 100%. But Krishna completely thoroughly knows us, and he loves us, he hangs around with us, even if we become a cockroach. You know that story by Franz Kafka, Metamorphosis, where the family comes to wake up their family member, and he's become a big cockroach. So even our surit jivas, if we became a big cockroach, they probably wouldn't like us anymore. But Krishna, right? Videsha Dunatistati, he's Yantra Rudrani Mayanam. And whatever yantra we're in, Krishna is still our best friend. So this surit, this best friend, does this cleansing, vidyunoti satam, of those who are truthful. Prabhupada translates it, Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who's the super soul in everyone's heart, and the benefactor of the truthful devotee, cleanses desire for material enjoyment from the heart of the devotee who has developed the urge to hear his messages, which are in themselves virtuous when properly heard and chanted. So how does this cleansing take place? This cleansing takes place, Gyanadipena Bhasvata, that as you hear about Krishna, He gets very pleased. He gets very excited. He manifests himself in the heart. Krishna is full of light and the heart gets lit up. And then if one is truthful and one wants to know the truth, then one will see one's material desires. One will see, Prabhupada said, the naked form of material desires. We'll discuss this a little bit more tomorrow, how to hear. Tomorrow we're going to talk about how to hear and how to preach. So we'll just kind of leave it at that, how. But the material desires become cleansed. Now, again, this may sound very nice, but the process of the cleansing is not very nice for a materially attached soul. Again, nobody told me this when I joined the Hare Krishna movement. So I'm sure most of you here already know this, but for those who don't, I'm going to give you fair warning, truth in advertising. So if you're attached to something, being cleansed of it will be experienced initially as painful. Okay, if you're attached to something, being cleansed of it will be experienced initially as painful. Because Bhagavatam will show us our attachments in their naked form. I always give the example of the person who has an exotic animal as a pet. Someone has a tiger as a pet or a python as a pet, and they think, this is a pet. It loves me. I love it. It is the source of affection for me. And then one day their pet eats them. And if you go to such persons and say, my dear sir, you are living with a python. He says, oh yeah, I know. But he doesn't know. So the Bhagavatam takes our material attachments and says, this is what they really are. And when you're attached to something that's horrible and disgusting and dangerous and selfish and greedy and exploitive and cruel, and you think it's very nice, seeing it for what it is painful. Now, the pain is due to our pride. But there's definitely some pain involved. Therefore, there's some humility. Therefore, the devotees will say, oh, I'm so fallen. So the Bhagavatam will do that. The Bhagavatam will say, hey, you're living like a hog, dog, camel, or ass. That's heavy. Now, all you're doing is eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. You're not better than an animal. Those are very harsh, heavy statements. Your life is useless. Shrama evahi kevalam. You can be a pious person doing so many wonderful things in the world, but if you haven't attained transcendence, it's all useless. Again, that's heavy. It's hard. Because we're thinking, oh, I'm great and I'm doing wonderful things and my life is full of meaning. And Bhagavatam says, no, it's not. It's empty. It just looks real. You say, oh, my life is full of pleasure. And Bhagavatam says, no, it's not. It's a forest of material enjoyment full of hooting owls, which are your enemies that behind your back are saying, oh, well, well. You know, and high mountains that you're climbing and caves you're falling into and tigers that are going to eat you and elephants that are going to trample you and witches that are going to suck your blood and thieves and all these parts of your life that you think, oh, they're wonderful. These are my family members. These are my friends. These are my meaningful activities in the world. I am an important person. I am a good person. I'm kind, I'm compassionate, I'm selfless. Bhagavatam says, no, you're not. You're greedy, lusty, envious, selfish, exploitive, contaminated dog who's suffering one after another with people who look like your friends and look like your family members, but actually they're just witches and jackals and thieves. And people run away, frankly. So a lot of people can't get past the showers. Again, we'll discuss this a little bit more tomorrow, but they don't realize that when you take a shower, you feel really good afterwards. That it may be a little painful to see how dirty you are, but then you figure out you need a shower, and then when you take a shower, you feel so good. As soon as they just see, look at me, oh my God, and then they turn around and run away. So we see many people, they just get to this cleansing process and they're not willing to be satam, they're not willing to be truthful. And so they turn around and run away. Or some of them stay and just become mechanical. So some people stay and just go on with mechanical service, which of course you can't keep up for too long, but keep it up probably for a few lifetimes. And some people run away. So then after one is cleansed, then what is the next stage? This is from the purport of 285. Prabhupada says, by sincere efforts to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, one realizes his constitutional relationship with the Lord in the transcendental humor of servitude, friendship, paternal affection, or conjugal love. And by such self-realization, one becomes situated at once in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. So what happens when you get clean? You see, oh, there was something nice under all that dirt. It wasn't just dirt. The dirt wasn't the real me, Chaito Darpanam Arjunam. The Bhagavatam's also revealing what we are. The Bhagavatam's revealing that when Ajamil realizes how dirty and contaminated he is, then he comes to who he is. He sees his, gets his spiritual form and he gets his relationship with the Lord. One starts to see, I'm a part of God, and not just I'm a part of God in a vague way, but one starts to experience, oh, I have feelings for the Lord as my friend or as my son or as my lover. And the real spiritual feelings start to awaken. Then one finds that there are real friends, and there are real family, and there are real meaningful activities, and there is a form that's actually kind and compassionate and truthful and wonderful, and I really am that. And then one starts to engage in bhakti on a different platform, on a platform of increasing one's attachment, on a platform of developing one's relationship, on a platform of meditating on the Lord in the context of that relationship. And the Bhagavatam gives you the keys to do that. Just like Prabhupada writes in the third chapter of the 10th canto, that one who's gotten feelings for the Lord as their child meditates on Mother Yasoda, how she's churning butter and she's perspiring and the flowers are falling from her hair. So the Bhagavatam gives us the means for meditation and entrance into who we really are. And when one meditates on that, when one starts meditating on Krishna in one's awakened feelings, then the next thing, one will come to see Krishna directly. This is from the purport of 1344. One can certainly see directly the presence of Lord Sri Krishna in the pages of the Bhagavatam. So after one has gone through the shower and one's real feelings have awakened, then when one starts reading the Bhagavatam, oh, there's Krishna. We were saying even a materialistic person, when they read a materialistic story, they experience that they're with the characters in that story. But here Krishna's actually there. And Prabhupada says one will see Krishna directly. Finally, one will see Krishna face to face. Prabhupada says, just like we're seeing each other. And what will be the result of that? So from the purport to 10, 12, 7, 11. Prabhupada says, if one adheres to these two books, Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, when assured to obtain the association of Krishna in the next life. Twaktudeham punarjanma naiti mameti sorjuna. So this is what the Bhagavatam can give us. It gives us freedom from the chains. It takes off the chains. It takes off the illusion. It clears the eyes. It clears off the dust. It shows us the reality. It shows us the actual nature of illusion. So we let it go. And that doesn't bring us to nothingness. It brings us to reality. It awakens our real self. Then we start doing activities on the basis of the real self, which allow us to see Krishna in the Bhagavatam. And by seeing Krishna in the Bhagavatam, then yam yam bhapi sram bhavam tvaja chante kalevram tam tam eva tikantaya saratad bhava bhavita. Just like, and Prabhupada explains this very nicely in the 8th chapter of Majjhalila, that just like in conditioned life, we get a particular body according to our meditation and activities. So spiritually, according to our meditation and activities, we develop our spiritual body and get to be with Krishna eternally. So that is what the Bhagavatam gives us. Cleansing, revelation of our real swarup, cleansing the illusion and the unreal, revealing the real me, revealing God, and bringing Ami into his association. So how do we get that from the Bhagavatam? One may say, well, I've been reading the Bhagavatam for a long time and I haven't seen all that. So that we will do, Krishna willing, tomorrow. How to read the Bhagavatam so as to access these jewels, and how to teach the Bhagavatam so as to access these jewels. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions.